Good morning. On today's programme, Paris mulls an Eiffel Tower car ban and Nigerians call for action over cases of kidnapping for ransom. But first we go to Turkey, which is struggling to cope with the grief and the demand for housing caused by two earthquakes which struck the country on February 6th last year. Jasper Mortimer attended a memorial service in the southeastern city of Adiyaman.
It was dark, past 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was cold, 2 degrees centigrade. As an imam sang passages from the Quran, a young woman grimaced with pain. A red traffic light illuminated her face. There was no traffic, because about 1,000 people had taken over the clock tower roundabout in central Adiyaman. The clock was stuck at 4:17. The time an earthquake of 7.8 magnitude struck on February the 6th last year. Another of 7.6 magnitude followed 9 hours later. And the two quakes killed 53,000 people in southern Turkey and 6,000 in northern Syria, the biggest natural disaster in 100 years. The grimacing woman was grieving for somebody she had loved. Another young woman in the crowd became hysterical, shouting the quake had killed her father. A tall man came up and calmed her with a hug. It is no exaggeration to say that in central Adiyaman, every block has an empty lot or an empty building. The empty lots are carpeted in rubble. The empty buildings are too cracked to inhabit. The people who used to live there now live in containers on the outskirts of the city. And on Tuesday morning, hundreds of people walked from the container cities to the clock tower, carrying placards saying, "Our hearts remain at 4:17. They chanted, "Sahip siz memleket, sahip siz memleket." We've been abandoned. When the crowd at the memorial service noticed a government official, it booed. "Why are they booing?" I asked a woman standing next to me. She said, "Because the government didn't help." Adiyaman suffered more than it should have last year. No rescue teams came for 2 whole days. People buried alive under the rubble were heard calling for help. And national media gave more attention to the 10 other provinces hit by the quakes. When a big TV network, Haber Türk, did reach Adiyaman, and its presenter began a live broadcast in front of a collapsed building, a paramedic walked up, grabbed the microphone, and accused the channel of ignoring the city. The paramedic said the people calling for help from under the rubble had now died of the cold. She walked towards the camera and shouted, "Turkey, wake up!" By the clock tower, a woman behind me tapped me on the shoulder. "Don't be scared," she said. "Report." Many Turks don't trust their media any longer. They look to foreign journalists. The next morning I was helping a colleague shoot a live broadcast at a container city when a man driving an old car stopped. He asked who I worked for. Then he said, "It's chaos here. The government isn't listening to us." At the time of the quake, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan promised the government would build 319,000 houses within a year. But only 46,000 have been built. Consequently, Turkey has 670,000 people, more than the population of Dublin, living in containers. The containers have kitchens, bathrooms, heating, and television, but they're small, 21 square meters. Last week, the state gave journalists a tour of the homes that have been finished. They're impressive, and they've been built on ground that has been tested for vulnerability to quakes. The buyers will have 20 years to pay, at no interest, and no payment for the first 2 years. But despite these generous terms, the people in the containers fear the new houses will be too expensive. To return to the clock tower, the ceremony ended with a sermon that was well received. No non-religious speeches were allowed. There was a shout of protest at that. The authorities didn't want to give voice to the crowd's mood. As I walked away from the clock tower, I came across some 20 people gathered around tea light candles laid out on an empty lot. The candles spelled out the words, "Justice for the children." These people were mourning the 35 boys, girls, and teachers from Cyprus who had come to Adıyaman for a volleyball tournament. Their hotel collapsed, killing them in their sleep. The hotel's owner and 10 others went on trial last month for violating construction codes. A placard on the ground bore a quotation, "Mummy, shall we take February out of the calendar?" This is a wound that continues to bleed. Jasper Mortimer for World Report in Turkey.
To Paris next, and the referendum, which was closely watched by other European capitals, including Dublin. Parisians this week voted in favour of tripling parking fees for large SUVs in a bid to reduce air pollution and improve road safety. Building on that success, the city mayor is now pushing for all cars to be banned from areas close to the Eiffel Tower, to the consternation of police chiefs, motorists groups, and residents. From Paris, Sharon Gaffney reports.
For a triumphant Anne Hidalgo, the socialist mayor of the French capital, Parisians had made a clear choice, sending a message of resistance by opting to triple parking fees for large SUVs. Less than a year after banning rented electric scooters in a similar referendum, voters in Paris backed proposals to increase charges for parking heavy, bulky and polluting cars from 6 to 18 euro an hour in the centre of the city and to 12 euro in areas a little further out. There'll be exemptions for the likes of taxi drivers, health workers and people with disabilities, while on-street parking for local residents will remain unchanged. Ahead of the vote, surveys suggested that more than 60% of Parisians were in favour of reducing the number of large vehicles clogging up the streets, but very few of them came out to have their say. Turnout at just 5.7%, some 78,000 people from an electorate of 1.3 million, was far lower than local officials and environmental advocates had hoped for. While few could argue with the merits of making roads safer for pedestrians or with the need to reduce carbon emissions and air pollution, the campaign was divisive, slammed by opponents as biased, manipulative, undemocratic and incomprehensible. Even the environment minister voiced concerns, describing the proposed tariffs as punitive. Motorist groups and politicians on the right were predictably scathing, condemning the ballot as an attack on freedom and an unjustified rebellion led by an ultra-urban and anti-car minority. And they argued that smaller, older diesel vehicles were more polluting than newer SUVs. Passed with the support of just under 55% of voters, the referendum also revealed a clear divide between sentiment in the capital's wealthier western neighbourhoods, home to the Eiffel Tower and the Champs-Élysées, where the measures were largely opposed, and more socially diverse areas in the east, where most residents opted to support them. Some voters also said they'd used the referendum to protest against the rising cost of living and what they described as the diktats of the city mayor. Regularly targeted by conservatives, Anne Hidalgo has made it her mission to make Paris greener since taking office in 2014. Under her watch, the city has pledged to phase out diesel vehicles and introduced low-emission zones. Over the past 4 years, 84 kilometres of cycling lanes and pedestrianised streets have been created, including along the banks of the River Seine. Other roads are closed to traffic on Sundays and public holidays, while speed limits and the number of on-street parking spaces have also been reduced. Despite those measures and as environmental concerns mount, demand for SUVs remains strong. While lower than the European average, their sales account for about 40% of the French market. They're not as popular in Paris, where only one in every three households owns a car and most people rely on public transport. Environmental groups had hoped the new tariffs would be in place for the Summer Olympics, with 15 million visitors expected for the Games. People are being strongly urged to travel around the city on foot or bike where possible. Cars will be kept from entering areas close to competition sites, and residents are being warned to expect significant disruption to metro and bus services. The city mayor is hoping to take advantage of the Olympics to garner support for her latest endeavour, a bid to permanently ban cars from roads near the Eiffel Tower, to the consternation of residents and police chiefs who fear that such a move would create significant traffic delays and slow down response times for emergency services. The plan was blocked by an administrative court last year, but Hidalgo says she's submitted a modified proposal and believes the Olympics will help her to win over reluctant hearts and minds. While SUV drivers who insist on getting behind the wheel to make their way around the city during the Games won't be subject to the increased tariffs, those here for the Paralympics are likely to be hit. The new charges are expected to come into effect on September 1st. For World Report in Paris, this is Sharon Gaffney.
Finally, we go to Nigeria. Kidnapping for ransom has become a major problem in Abuja, Nigeria's capital, as criminal gangs target highways, homes and even schools. Although Nigeria's president, Bola Tinubu, has verbally condemned the attacks, Nigerians are calling for more actionable steps to end the menace. Polum David in Abuja reports.
Sadly, kidnapping is quite a common occurrence in Nigeria. Gangs often kidnap people from their cars and demand ransom money from family members. However, the situation has deteriorated dramatically in the last year, and the bandits are now even kidnapping people in the middle of the night from their homes. All this has contributed to rising insecurity. A public servant was abducted from his home at midnight, very close to a military base in Bwari Area Council of Abuja. Two teenage sisters were also kidnapped by gunmen suspected to be bandits at Goita community in the same area council. The kidnappers asked for a ransom of 30 million naira, which is over $20,000. Kidnappers have also abducted and killed a nursing mother and grandmother in Abuja for failing to pay 90 million naira, which is over $60,000 ransom in Abuja. Former Vice President Atiku Abubakar has also tackled President Bola Tinubu over the country's security situation, particularly the recurrent kidnappings across the nation. Atiku, who contested against Tinubu during the 2023 presidential election, asked the president to step aside if he can't handle the worsening insecurity in the country. But the presidency replied, saying President Tinubu approved 50 billion naira, which is over $35 million, as a special fund to address some of the lingering security issues in northern Nigeria, and also approved funds for the acquisition of equipment to track criminals. Meanwhile, Nigerians are not entirely buying this. Sokoman Ezekiel, a civil society activist, said sustainable infrastructure development is critical to security, peace, stability and prosperity in the society. Abuja's Commissioner for Public Complaints, Dalhatu Ezekiel, has asked the federal government to prioritize Abuja's security situation and immediately declare a state of emergency. Awal Rasfajani, Executive Director of the Civil Society Legislative Advocacy Center, speaking on behalf of more than 40 civil society groups, has petitioned Nigerian President Bola Tinubu, calling on him to address chronic insecurity that has only gotten worse since he assumed office last May. According to a report by the Civil Society Coalition, at least 2,400 people have been killed and close to 1,900 others kidnapped since May last year, when Tinubu assumed office. Five siblings were abducted from their father's house in Bwari Area Council Abuja alongside their father. Although their father was later released to go and raise the ransom, the kidnappers killed one of his daughters after the man failed to raise the ransom. Relatives of the man took to social media to crowdfund the ransom of about 60 million naira. Following this, former Nigerian minister Professor Issa Pantami revealed that a friend had pledged 50 million naira to contribute to funds for the ransom demanded by kidnappers for the release of the sisters. However, the Nigerian police force has said that crowdfunding for kidnap ransom on social media is an illegal and punishable offence. Spokesperson of the Nigerian police force, Olumuyiwa Adejobi, said such actions demoralize police personnel, stressing that paying a ransom is criminal in Nigeria. The Minister of Defence, Abubakar Badaru, also warns against public crowdfunding to pay ransoms for kidnapped victims, saying it will only worsen the spate of abductions. James Burnett, a specialist in Nigerian politics and security at the U.S. think tank Hudson Institute, said that announcing the amount raised on social media before victims are released could inform terrorists and their network of informants that the family had wealthy benefactors whom they could exploit even more. Oluwole Ojewale, a security analyst, says ransom enriches the treasury of armed groups and they funnel the same money to acquire sophisticated weapons, drugs and food. Meanwhile, Abuja's minister, Nyesom Wike, says the government is taking steps to address security challenges affecting the country's capital. And President Tinubu recalling a promise during his inaugural speech last year that security would be the top priority of his administration, says he will continue to re-professionalize and re-equip the armed forces and security agencies to effectively discharge their duties in safeguarding lives and properties. For World Report, I am Polum David in Abuja, Nigeria.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.